Please turn in your Bibles to Mark chapter 3. We're going to read Mark 3, 1 to 6, and then turn to Mark chapter 15. So Mark chapter 3, verses 1 to 6. Let us hear the word of the Lord. Again, Jesus entered the synagogue, and a man was there with a withered hand. And they watched Jesus to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man with the withered hand, "Come here." And he said to him, to them, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill?" But they were silent. And he looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, and said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. Please turn forward to chapter 15 and verse 21. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. And they brought him to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, "Behold, he is calling Elijah." And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down." And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly this man was the Son of God." Please have your Bibles open at Mark chapter 3. We'll begin there and then we'll move to Mark chapter 15. A father says to his 5-year-old daughter, "Where did you get the color of your hair from?" And she replies in her simplicity, "From God." And then she grows up and heads off to university and studies genetics. And after her graduation, her father says to her, "Where did you get the color of your hair from?" And she replies, "From the dominant genes in my mother and father's DNA." Which answer is true? Which answer is more fundamental? Another father says to his 5-year-old son, "How do the birds feed?" And in his simplicity, he says, "God feeds the birds." And then as he grows up and observes life and birds in the garden, his father says to him one day, "How do the birds feed?" And he says, "Well, they fly around and they look for food and they pick up berries and they eat seeds." Which answer's true? Which answer is more fundamental? And it's the same with the question, why did Jesus die? Why did Jesus die? Because the gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, give us two answers. In Mark chapter 3, we saw the first answer at the end in verse 6. Jesus died because he got on the wrong side of the wrong people, claiming to be God's chosen king, and so they crucified him. This is the first answer that the gospel writers give us as to why Jesus died. Mark chapter 3 here comes at the end of a sequence of conflicts between Jesus and the religious leaders. And here in chapter 3, it comes to a climax. Jesus initiates the conflict. He calls this man with a withered hand to stand up in front of everyone. And then he asks the question in verse 4, knowing the religious leaders are sitting there. Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill? But they were silent. And then Jesus ups the ante again, and he looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, and he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored. And what's the result? The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. Why did Jesus die? Well, because he got on the wrong side of the wrong people, claiming to be God's chosen king, and so they crucified him. Mahatma Gandhi, the great father of India, died on the 30th of January 1948 as he was walking on a way to a prayer meeting. He was shot dead by a man in the crowd who he got on the wrong side of. This was a member of the opposition who opposed his political and social ideology, and he got on the wrong side. He annoyed him too much, and the man shot him and killed him. Is Jesus' death in the same vein? Did he simply get on the wrong side of the wrong people, claiming to be God's chosen king, and so they crucified him? Well, we've seen in Mark chapter 3 and Mark chapter 14, as you read the trial and the crucifixion, you see that that answer is true. Jesus got on the wrong side of the wrong people, and so they crucified him. But that's not Mark's only answer. As you read the book of Mark, you realize that Jesus getting on the wrong side of the wrong people is not the only reason why he died. There is a more fundamental answer. There is a more fundamental reason to the question, why did Jesus die? Just like there's a more fundamental question, answer to the question, where did you get the color of your hair from? Or how do the birds feed? And Mark, in chapter 15, gives us the more fundamental answer as to why Jesus died. But on the way to chapter 15, come with me to Mark chapter 8, verse 31, where Jesus begins to give us an insight to why he died, the more fundamental answer. Chapter 8, verse 31. And Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. Now there's the first answer. He gets on the wrong side of the wrong people. Look at chapter 9, verse 31. For he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days, he will rise. You see that? Getting on the wrong side of the wrong people. And then chapter 10, verse 32. And they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them. And they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was going to happen to him, saying, see, we're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise. So why did Jesus die? Well, Jesus explains that he's going to get on the wrong side of the wrong people and they are going to crucify him. But then look at chapter 10 and verse 45. When he's alone with the disciples, here is the more fundamental reason why he will die. 10 verse 45. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Here's the second answer to the question, why did Jesus die? He died to give his life as a ransom for many. That's the interpretation of his death that Jesus gives. Yes, he died because he gets on the wrong side of the wrong people. Jesus says that three times. I'm going up to Jerusalem. I'll be handed over to the chief priests, the scribes, the Pharisees. They will mock me, kill me, etc. But here, he gives us another insight, the more fundamental reason of his death, to give his life as a ransom for many. Here is the more fundamental reason. And when we come to chapter 15, Mark gives us three proofs that Jesus was telling the truth. Three proofs that he died to give his life as a ransom. Three proofs that his life was not just getting on the wrong side of the wrong people, like Mahatma Gandhi did. Number one, Jesus died in darkness. Jesus died in darkness. He was forsaken by God. Chapter 15, verse 33 to 34. And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now this darkness in verse 33 is a phenomenon precisely because the sixth hour that Jesus is crucified at is midday, when the sun is at its highest and brightest, and the ninth hour is 3 o'clock. So for 3 hours, when the sun is at its highest and brightest, there is total darkness. In the Bible, darkness plays a key role in God's judgments. In Exodus, darkness was the penultimate plague in Egypt before the death of the firstborn sons of Egypt. It symbolized God's wrath and judgment. In Amos, darkness symbolizes the coming day of judgment. Amos 8, verse 9, in that day declares the Lord, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight. I will make that day like morning for an only sun. So darkness here is a phenomenon, and it is a sign of God's wrath. It occurs in the middle of the day when you wouldn't expect it. And it is a sign that God's judgment day has come. It has fallen on Christ. And hence why Jesus cries out in verse 34, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? The words are a quote from Psalm 22, where David pleads for God to intervene on behalf of the righteous sufferer. Yet what's interesting here is that God does not intervene. Rather, he abandons Jesus. He forsakes him. But think about how strange that is. My God, why have you forsaken me? These words are so familiar to us that we don't see the shock in that. Those words are shocking. Because here is God's perfect Son. This is not a sinner saying these words. This is the Son of God, the perfect man who had lived in complete obedience to his Father throughout his entire life. Why have you forsaken me? Because I have obeyed you. I have done what you asked me to do. Listen to the words of Isaiah 59. But your iniquities have separated you from your God. Your sins have hidden his face from you so that he will not hear. But Jesus hadn't sinned. And yet here is God hiding his face from him. Here is God turning away from him. Here is God pouring out his wrath and judgment on Jesus. All the agonies and pains of hell are poured on Jesus in this one horrific moment. No wonder the hymn writer wrote, "Well might the sun in darkness hide and shut his glories in when Christ the mighty maker died for man the creature's sin." On the cross, here, Jesus experiences the forsakenness of God. He experiences hell itself, hence the cry of dereliction. And it is the darkness, it is the cry in the darkness that shows us that this is not just another crucifixion. This is not just one man getting on the wrong side of the wrong people, so they crucified him. Here is a man giving his life as a ransom for sin. He is forsaken by God in the dark. Now, sadly, this is not how most people in our society view Jesus' death. When people read or hear about his death, they often feel sorry for him. They pity him. You see this kind of misguided response when Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, came out. When it came out, everyone in my workplace went to see it in the movies, and I remember the main response of everyone who saw it was pity. They pitied Jesus. They pitied what had happened to him, forsaken by his own people, forsaken by God. They pitied him. But Jesus did not die to win our sympathy. He died to win our immunity. When Jesus died, he did not receive the pity of the Father. He received the punishment of the Father. Jesus took our hell so that we don't have to go to hell. He cried, "Why have you forsaken me?" so that we don't ever have to cry, "Why have you forsaken me?" This was no ordinary crucifixion. Here was a death that was a ransom for many people. And the first proof of that, more fundamental answer of why Jesus died, the first proof, he died in darkness, in the middle of the day, forsaken by God. The second proof is that Jesus refused one drink, but accepted another drink. He refused one drink, but accepted another drink, which signified that he gave up his own life. Look at verse 23. "And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it." And then verse 35, after he says, "Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani," they think he's calling Elijah, because that sounds like Elijah. And so they say, "Behold, he's calling Elijah." And some ran and filled a sponge with sour wine. So a different kind of wine. The first wine is, first drink is wine mixed with myrrh. This is sour wine. And they put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. So he refuses the first drink, the wine mixed with myrrh, and he accepts the second drink. Okay, what's the significance in that? Well, wine mixed with myrrh was used to numb the consciousness of crucifixion and help speed up the death. So here is Jesus refusing the drink that would anesthetize him and speed up his death. But here is Jesus accepting another drink, sour wine. This drink was a refreshing drink. It prolonged your life. So do you see what happens? Jesus refuses the drink that will speed up his life. He accepts the drink that will prolong his life. But then look what happens immediately in verse 37. "Then Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last." Instead of his life being prolonged, Jesus gives up his life. In fact, it appears that this loud cry, which was virtually impossible for a crucified person, and his last breath are active responses to the mockers. He's showing that he is in total control of his life, even at this point. Here is a willing sacrifice. His life is not taken from him, it is given by him. This is why Jesus did not die by crucifixion. He died by giving up his own life. It's why the Apostles' Creed makes the distinction between crucified, dead, and buried. Why doesn't it just say crucified and buried? Because if you were crucified, you died, and then you were buried. Well, it says crucified, dead, and buried because Jesus did not die by crucifixion. He was crucified, yes, and then on the cross he gave up his own life. And we see this through the two drinks. The one he refuses, the other he accepts. And by taking the drink that should prolong his life, but then giving up his life, it shows us that his own death was a self-sacrificial giving, a ransom for many people. We can see that it was a ransom paid to God because of verses 29 to 31. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others, but he cannot save himself." Those words are so true. Ironically true. Yes, exactly. If he is going to save others, he cannot save himself. But he doesn't save himself so that he can save others. That's because he was giving his life as a ransom. This matches exactly what we saw in Mark chapter 10, verse 45. "I have not come," said Jesus, "to be served, but to serve and to give my life as a ransom for many people." Here's the second proof that Jesus gave his life as a ransom for people, that he died, not because he got on the wrong side of the wrong people, but because he was giving his life as a ransom payment to God. He refused the drink that should shorten his life. He accepted the drink that should prolong his life. And then he died immediately after. So we've seen the first proof. He died in the darkness, forsaken by God. We've seen the second proof. He refused one drink, accepted another, and gave up his life. And third, the third proof that Jesus died to give his life as a ransom is that the temple curtain was torn. Jesus removed God's barrier. The temple curtain was torn. Verse 37. "And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom." In the Jewish temple, there were two rooms. The most holy place, the perfect cube, symbolizing heaven, God's throne room. And then there was the holy place, a rectangular shaped room. And then there was the courtyard. And separating the courtyard from the holy place, the most holy place, was a curtain. And then separating the most holy place from the holy place was another curtain. It had the symbol of angels embroidered into it. It was 4 inches thick, 60 foot high. Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us that it took 100 men to raise this curtain into place. This curtain was a visible sign that people could not just walk into God's presence. Since Adam sinned in the garden, man had been expelled from God's presence. And you remember the cherubim with a flashing sword of judgment. And of course, what that symbolized was that the only way back into Eden was for someone to go under the sword, to die and rise again and get to the tree of life. And here is this curtain symbolizing this barrier. And as Jesus dies, the camera, if you like, flicks from him on the cross to the curtain temple, another part of the city. And we see it torn from top to bottom. It is a divine tearing. It is impossible for man to tear it from bottom to top, never mind from top to bottom. It is a divine tearing, and it symbolized two things. First, it symbolized that this was the end of Jewish religion, the end of the temple physically in Jerusalem, the end of the sacrifices. In Mark chapter 11 to 13, Jesus has been predicting the end of old Israel, the judgment coming on Israel. And when the curtain is torn, it's saying that the sacrificial system of the priests and the sacrifices is over. But just as significantly, and secondly, it is symbolizing access to God is now open. Jesus has paid a price in his death that has torn open the way back to God, into his holy presence. And it is torn, as I said, from the top to the bottom. This is a divine tearing. This is not just some natural event. This is another phenomenon, like the darkness at midday. So this is the third proof that Jesus died to give his life as a ransom for sinners. The curtain temple was torn. Jesus opened or removed the barrier to God's presence. Now let me return to that question that I began this sermon with. Why did Jesus die? Well, on the one hand, we've seen that in chapter 3, he gets on the wrong side of the wrong people, and so they plot to kill him. And then in chapter 8 and chapter 9 and chapter 10, we saw Jesus predicting that he was going to be handed over to people and crucified. And that is one answer, and it is true. But what does Mark tell us when it actually comes to the crucifixion? He tells us that there's a second answer, and it's the answer that Jesus gives. He has come to give his life as a ransom for people, for sinners like you and me. And Mark gives us three proofs of that. Jesus died in the darkness at midday, forsaken by God. Jesus refuses one drink to speed up his death, takes the other drink to prolong his life, and then gives up his life. And the temple curtain is torn. Jesus removed God's barrier. This is why Jesus died. This is the more fundamental reason why he died. And the question that we each need to ask ourselves this evening is, do we see it? Do you see that as you hear about the cross of Jesus this evening? Or do we just see that he got on the wrong side of the wrong people, so they crucified him? Do we see the more fundamental reason why Jesus died? And the reason I ask, do we see it, is because this is Mark's concern. Three times in this account, he uses the word see. Verse 32, let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe. Verse 35, and some of the bystanders hearing it said, behold, he's calling Elijah. And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink, saying, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down. And then verse 39, and when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, truly this man was the Son of God. Do you see it? Do you see the seeing? When you read Mark's gospel, you realize there are only two responses to Jesus: the response of blind people and the response of seeing people. The blind are in this passage. Did you notice them? Verse 29 to 32. The mockers, come down from the cross so that we might see and believe. Verse 35, he's calling Elijah, let's wait and see if Elijah comes. What's ironic is that all the evidence they need in order to see and believe is right before their very eyes, above Jesus' head. Verse 26, the King of the Jews. Psalm 22, their very own scriptures. My God, why have you forsaken me? What is done to David in that psalm is done to Jesus. They cast lots for his clothes, verse 24. They pierce his hands and feet, verse 25. They shake their heads and mock him, verse 29 to 32. Yet they don't realize that their very actions of casting lots, of shaking their heads, of mocking him, are the very proof that he is God's Messiah, who has come to make a payment for their sin. Their statements are ironically true. He saved others. Himself he cannot save. Yes, exactly. He cannot save himself if he is going to save others. And what's most sad is that they think they are in charge of determining who Jesus is. Come down from the cross and then we'll see who you are and we'll believe. But all the evidence is right before their very eyes. Reminds me of the story of the hippies in the 1960s who were making their way through Paris, and they stopped in one of the great museums in Paris and stood there half drunk mocking these great paintings. And one of the attendants in the museum was so disgusted hearing the comments, he walked up behind them and said, "Messieurs, in this musée, it is not the paintings that are being judged." In other words, your response to the painting does not determine the quality of the painting. It determines the quality of who you are. And that's the same with Jesus' death. Our response to his death does not determine who he is. It determines who we are. Whether we're blind, like these mockers, or whether we see. Which brings us to the one person in this passage who does see. Verse 39. When the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, saw how he died, he said, "Truly this man was the Son of God." The mockers call on Jesus to come down from the cross, and then they will see. Jesus stays on the cross and dies, and a Roman centurion sees. The mockers think that Jesus' survival will provide the identity, the revelation of his identity, but it is Jesus' death that provides the revelation of his identity. And it's not a mistake that Mark has placed the tearing of the temple curtain in between Jesus' death and the centurion's confession. Because tearing in Mark is revealing. Mark chapter 1, the heavens are torn open, same word. And God says, "This is my beloved Son." Mark chapter 15, the curtain temple is torn and a Roman centurion says, "Surely this is the Son of God." Now think about how shocking that is for this centurion. This was the soldier who was in charge of Jesus' crucifixion. He ordered his beating. He allowed the mockery. He ordered the nails to be driven in. He mocked Jesus himself along with the other soldiers. Yet when he sees how he dies, taking a drink that should prolong his life and then immediately giving up his last breath, he says, "There's something unique about this man. This is no ordinary crucifixion. This is like no crucifixion I have ever seen before." What he saw was the Son of God on a cross, dying for him. And when he saw it, he believed. Because seeing is believing. When God opens our eyes, we can do nothing else but believe. It's irresistible, it's inevitable, because seeing is believing. And so the question for all of us this evening is, do you see it? And if you see it, then rejoice. Rejoice because, first of all, you didn't open your own eyes. God opened your eyes. See, why is it that in this passage the Roman centurion gets to see and the mockers don't get to see? Was the Roman centurion more righteous than the mockers? No. God's sovereign electing grace to open the eyes of a centurion. So if you're here this evening and you see it, then rejoice that God opened your eyes. And then rejoice that all your sins are paid for. Because isn't the proof there? He died in the darkness. He refused one drink, accepted another drink. The temple curtain was torn. Isn't all the proof there that as a sinner, you can be forgiven and are forgiven and have access to God? But if you don't see it, then understand that it's not your response who determines who Jesus is. It's Jesus who determines who you are. Blind. And It's a horrible thing to be blind. So why not ask God to open your eyes?